Hello, this is Paul Gambaccini. Welcome to the first part of the Simon and Garfunkel story. Today, Grimsby. Tomorrow, the world.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone.
When The Sound of Silence topped the American charts in January 1966, it seemed as if Simon and Garfunkel had popped up from nowhere. But in fact, they'd been making music together for almost 10 years. As Art Garfunkel recalls, their friendship began at their local school in the New York borough of Queens.
We were friends from the sixth grade, where we met each other in June of 53. As we graduated grade school, and that was the sixth grade, they had cast both of us in the Alice in Wonderland graduation play. He as the rabbit and me as the Cheshire Cat. Just recently, I've only come to know that he, in fact, knew of me from 2 years prior to that. In the fourth grade, I was the kid in school who sang, and I would sing in the synagogue with my white satin gown and move the people in their pews to tears. I had a voice at a young age, and I was using it in... for popularity's sake. The girls would like me, and I was a kind of a little singing angel in my grade school days. And Paul perceived that this is a way to popularity. And he says, only recently did he say, I knew of you in the hallways. I would pass, we were never in the same class in those days, but I would pass and go, there's that kid who sings. And he was thinking, I guess, I have my eyes set to meet this guy and befriend him later. And that's what happened in the sixth grade. So he was somewhat pitching to win me over, and all I knew is this is the funniest, cleverest kid in the neighborhood, clearly the most interesting person in the neighborhood. I often think of the phrase turned on. He was a turned on guy. You know what I mean? Some people just have a stronger life force, a sense that there's something to be done with me and my powers and my talents. Others, most at that age, don't realize that. They are busy following the programming that parents are giving them.
Earth angel.
Garfunkel were united by a mutual passion for rhythm and blues, which through spellbinding records by the Penguins, the Moonglows, Johnny Ace, and other exotically named stars, were gripping the hearts of teenagers across America. Paul Simon's whole life was changed by what he was discovering on the radio.
I was lucky to hear this music at an age where I was very impressionable, and so it made a big effect upon me. I was 12, 13, 14 years old, and the thing about rock and roll was that it was just simply universal, in the sense that it was all the music that there was for young kids growing up in New York.
Hello, everybody. Hi, all tonight. This is Alan Freed, the old king of the Moondoggers, and it's time again for another of your favorite rock and roll sessions, blues and rhythm records for all the gang in the Moondog Kingdom.
A disc jockey with more hype and heat and enthusiasm than anything that radio had known. And when he played the records, they were wonderfully subversive, dirty records. They sounded so down from Harlem. And I was hooked, and I told Paul, and both of us were regular listeners from 7 to 10, and then it was expanded. I think we had a cream-colored plastic radio, about 12 inches wide. And Alan Freed's show was on WINS, W-I-N-S, 1010 on the dial, a little to the right of center. You tried to do your homework while you're listening, but homework lost that. And kids would call in with their dedications, from this boyfriend to this girlfriend, listen to this record. And Alan Freed had this wonderfully heated up style. He would pound his telephone book to the backbeats while the record was playing. And we got to hear Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis and It was so much more interesting than anything going on in the rest of music, and frankly, anything going on in America.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing out run my V8
thing was pretty well black. It was very rare for white kids like us to take to it, but I must say it was Don and Phil that hooked us. When we heard Bye Bye Love, we knew there was a chance for us, the Everlys. The Everlys were just plain great. I mean, what can you say? They were just so superb. Just, if you love music, you had to love their accuracy, their hipness. I think I was an Everly Brother fan in the middle of the intro to Bye Bye Love, the first time I heard it, and they hadn't even started singing yet. Just chunk, 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 chunk. Right there, I said, what's this? So that was galvanizing the wonderful Everly Brothers.
Bye bye love. Bye bye happiness. Hello loneliness. I think I'm gonna cry.
When the Everly Brothers record first appeared, I mean, they became our model. In those days, the majors, the big record companies, didn't record rock and roll. So it was up to these little labels to record the local groups. And Art and I used to go, when we were 14 years old, we would go around to the record companies and knock on the door and go in and audition. I mean, that's how easy it was. You could knock on the door and come in, there would be a secretary there, it'd be like an office of maybe two rooms, and we'd say, well, we write songs and we sing, and they'd say, oh, well, yeah, let's hear it. So you'd take out my $25 guitar, and we'd stand up and sing. And I think we even signed a recording contract when we were 14 years old. We never made a record. We didn't make a record till a year later when we were 15. And when we made the record, I'm sure my parents were just shocked that we actually made a record and that the record came out and was on the radio. And the record became a hit. It was a hit nationally, not a huge hit nationally. It was in the top 50. But in New York, it was in the top 10.
Ooh-bop-a-loo-chi-bop, you're mine. Say, ooh-bop-a-loo-chi-bop, you're mine. Hey, schoolgirl in the second row. Teacher's looking over, so I gotta whisper way down low. To say, ooh, bopper, loot your boss, let's meet at the school after.
Hey Schoolgirl gave a fleeting taste of fame to Tom and Jerry, as the record company wittily called them.
The record sold 150,000 copies, and we were off and running as little mini celebrities getting the, at high school age, there's nothing more fun than having a record on the radio as far as impressing the kids in school.
Just to be on television when you were in high school, being on Dick Clark's American Bandstand made you a hero. And to have a record that was played on the radio and became a hit, it was a top 10 hit. It was very unusual, and it was very heady times for us.
In the years that followed their short-lived success, Art concentrated on his education, while Paul couldn't wait to get out of Queens College every evening and head for Manhattan, where he quickly infiltrated the studio scene, making demos and releasing singles under a variety of pseudonyms.
Hey! Get up and do the wobble. Oh, won't you please?
Oh, won't you please
do the wobble with me?
One of many Jack Cheerios, Gathering Dust in the Paul Simon Vaults, Get Up and Do the Wobble by Tico and the Triumphs. But while Paul was experimenting with different musical styles, Art was following a more conventional course.
I more or less went to becoming the middle-class student, and Paul stayed more into the world of demos, and I was going to Columbia and figuring out my major and treating my music thing as a side hobby that wasn't really going to be my profession. I had to do something proper, like lawyer or architect. I wrote a few things of a folky style and had a couple of recording contracts with different labels. I recorded for Warwick, and a label called Octavia made a record called Private World, which I wrote, and it's nice. It's a pretty song. It was very much in the style of Greenfields, the Brothers Four. Once there were Greenfields kissed by the sun. So I was into that melodic, kind of very pretty white sound.
Now I recall love when it died, how we both parted, how we both cried. People still ask why we two are apart. People don't know what I wish in my heart. Just you and I sharing our own private world.
Private World by Art Garfunkel, or Artie Gar, as he was calling himself at the time. By 1963, Paul Simon was also making a shift towards contemporary folk music, which was now becoming fashionable with the college crowd.
I mean, rock and roll was at that point considered to be stupid. Well, it was stupid, of course, you know, I mean, it was very young. And when you were 14, hearing new sounds for the first time, that seemed very sophisticated. But 5-6 years later, at age 20, it just seemed naive and strained, too, because they were trying to find some kind of hook. So the folk movement came with a sort of intelligence. It was an older group anyway. And it tapped into another part of American culture that was rich. And then came the folk scene at Bleecker and McDougal in the Village, and Bob Dylan as the key figure in that scene. And the subject matter suddenly became young adult, as opposed to teenage, our parents don't understand us, subject matter. Suddenly became, this is how I see the world, and it's not so great. And it became the viewpoint of a bright 21-year-old mind or 22-year-old mind.
Fog's rolling in off the East River bank like a shroud. It covers Bleecker Street, fills the alleys where men sleep, hides the shepherd from the sheep. Voices leaking from a sad cafe, smiling faces try to understand. I saw a shadow touch a shadow's hand on Bleecker Street.
One of Paul Simon's earliest folk compositions, Bleecker Street. And it was while he was exploring this new singer-songwriter field that he bumped into his old friend Art.
I missed him during those 5 years of 58, 9, 60, 61. Never spoke to him, never saw him, so I don't know. I would say the key word there is Bob Dylan. I think Bob Dylan intrigued Paul enormously. And anybody worth their salt would have loved Dylan's sound, his look, and particularly the style of his writing. After the 5 year break, when I refound Paul, I found him as this folk writer. And the first one he played me was He Was My Brother. Then he wrote a song called On the Side of a Hill. When I met him, he was up to song number 2 or so. He had a song called Carlos Dominguez. And I just loved the stuff, and I added my harmony, and he loved what I was doing. And I just sort of poured on a lot of the reinforcement. Make no doubt about it, Paul. This is hot stuff. And we heard that as we sung it together, it was very commercial. Before the world gets to hear what you do, your own ears are the first spectators of what you're doing. So the first people who are going to get excited is yourself. And I remember we'd rehearse at the fraternity house and A.E. Pye, Queens College, and they had wonderful plaster walls, so our sound had a great reverb off the walls, and any kids who passed by would stop in their tracks and hear such a professional-sounding thing. I knew we were onto something. And I think with that kind of, we're back together again now, came a lot of songs. I believe I might have helped a lot to get Paul into more and more, keep it going. The third song was Who Will Love a Little Sparrow. Then came Bleecker Street. Then came Wednesday Morning 3 a.m., the fifth one. The sixth one was called The Sound of Silence.
In restless dreams I walked alone. Narrow streets of cobblestone. Neath the hill of a street lamp. I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed. Night and touch the sound of silence, and in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more, people talking without speaking, people hearing without listening, people writing songs. No one dared disturb the sound of silence. Who said I, you do not know?
The Sound of Silence, one of the original songs on Wednesday Morning 3 a.m., the debut album by Paul and Art, now reconstituted as Simon and Garfunkel. After years of scrabbling to make it on small independent labels, the duo had now been signed up by one of America's major record companies.
We were now Columbia recording artists. And they gave us some songs that, you know, that they wanted us to record on their folk songs and some Dylan songs, because they were really strongly pushing Dylan. Turns they were changing, they gave to us. And then about five or six songs of mine. And they put out the record, Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m. And then put on the label whatever new exciting sounds in the folk tradition or something, which really embarrassed us. But we didn't have any control over anything that the record company did or said at that point.
Despite the sheen of their harmonies and the strength of Paul's writing, critics took one look at the sleeve, which portrayed the duo as clean-cut college kids in smart suits and ties, and dismissed them as commercial claim jumpers. Meanwhile, Britain was just waking up to contemporary folk, and when Paul traveled to London in summer 1964, he found a responsive audience for his songs. By chance, an impromptu floor spot at a Soho club was witnessed by Judith Piepi, earth mother of the local folk scene.
Paul got up and sang A Church Is Burning, which just knocked me for six, and then He Was My Brother, Leaves That Are Green, Sound of Silence. I mean, I was really knocked out. I knew this was the real thing. You know, this was a true prophet. There was this bloke whom nobody had heard of before, and I knew that this is the voice of now. I went up to Paul and said, "Thank you very much. I think you're a very great artist."
My brother, 5 years older than I. He was my brother, 23 years old, the day he died. Freedom rider, cursed my brother to his face. Go home, outsider. Mississippi's gonna be your burying place.
See, Judith heard Paul in the clubs, and Judith is a religious social worker. And really a wonderful bohemian, just a really good heart for breaking the boring proper rules and trying to be of help to people who need help. So she had the ears and the guts to go out on a limb and say, he's not only good, but he's wonderful. He writes great stuff. He needs help. This is a serious American songwriter. And I thought, great, there's the first person who knows what I know. Now there's two of us. And Judith did everything she could to get Paul on the radio and offered him a chance to live free at her house.
Paul moved into Judith Piepi's flat in London's East End, where a motley collection of other folk singers, including Sandy Denny, Jackson C. Frank, and Al Stewart, also nestled under her wing. Through her connections with the religious broadcasting department at BBC Radio, she eventually convinced a producer to use Paul on the Light program's regular Thought for the Day slot, 5 to 10.
In the widest sense, Paul's songs are religious. And I nagged them, and I said, look, you can't let this leave the country without something staying here. This is the greatest songwriter of our time. No, you haven't heard of him. Nobody has bloody heard of him, you know. But something got to be done. And I kept phoning them, I mean, sort of three times a day, generally driving everybody up the wall. I can be quite horribly persistent, you see, when I think there's something worth being persistent about. In the end, Roy Trevelyan turned up. And of course, once he'd listened to Paul, he knew there was something, you see. So he got an hour's studio time. We went to the BBC, and Paul recorded a dozen songs in this hour. I mean, straight off. And then I did short commentaries to fill in the time between the length of the song and 4 minutes, 40 seconds.
Last year, I happened to have been up with some friends in Oxford, and one night, after staying out about the whole night talking and kidding around, the dawn broke, and we decided to walk out, and you know, through the fields, because it happened to have been a wooded area. And one of the kids who was with us recited this poem because we heard a bird singing, and the poem was about a cuckoo, and the poem was, April, come she will, May she will stay, June she'll change her tune, July she will fly, August die she must. And I thought it was a groovy little poem, so I put music to it. Streams are ripe and swelled with rain. May she will stay, resting in my arms again. June, she'll change her tune. In restless walks she'll prowl the night. July she will fly and give no warning of her flight. August die she must. The autumn winds blow chilly and cold. September I'll remember. A love once new has now grown old.
Could I hear a little of that back? Still across fine, Paul. Quite fine.
One of the 12 songs recorded by the BBC in January 1965, April Come She Will. Broadcast in the 5 minutes before the top-rated program Saturday Club, the songs were heard by millions, and the BBC was deluged with letters asking where they could find Paul Simon records. In May, Paul decided to make London his permanent base.
I saw it this way. Everything seemed, in its size, so manageable. The cars were so much smaller that I remember thinking when I first went there, I don't even think you could be injured if you walked across the street and you were hit by a car, because these cars are so small. And the streets were small, and everything seemed smaller and much more manageable and more in a human proportion. I fell in love with being away from America and leaving New York. I remember thinking that I liked the smell of coal burning in fireplaces and the smell of wool sweaters. And I think what happened to me is what happened to a lot of English people who came to America, is that you got swept up in the foreignness of it, and at the same time you were able to fit in because of the language.
Introducing some new sounds in the folk tradition by Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel.
It's a hot and dusty road, a hard and a heavy load, and the people that I meet ain't always kind. Some are bad, some are good, some have done the best they could. Some have tried to ease my trouble in mind, and I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. I have traveled this whole land, I have done the best I can, trying to find what I was meant to do. And the faces that I see look as worried as can be, and it seems like they are wondering too. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound. I had a little girl one time, she had lips like sherry wine, and she loved me till my mind went plumb insane. But I was too blind to see she was drifting away from me, and she left one day on the morning train. And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound.
I had a buddy way back home, but he started out to roam, and I believe he's down by Frisco Bay. And sometimes when I've had a few, his voice comes ringing through, and I'm going back to see him some old day.
And I can't help but wonder where I'm bound, where I'm bound. Can't help but wonder where I'm bound.
An exclusive BBC recording of Simon and Garfunkel performing the Tom Paxton song, I Can't Help But Wonder Where I'm Bound. Having made such a startling impact with his 5 to 10 songs, Paul had been rebooked for a 15-minute special broadcast in July 1965. Since it was during his college holiday, Art had flown to London to join in the fun.
We would get up at Judith's house, and she'd have monks coming over, these guys in brown robes with rope belts. And they would sit around and have tea with Judith and talk about all stuff. And then by 3 or 4, we'd get ready to go to the train station and go up to Grimsby to do a show and come home that night. And they paid us £20. It was very lucrative.
You may have noticed recently that there's been a recent upsurge of pop groups doing folk-type material. So you have the Byrds doing Bob Dylan and Manfred Mann doing Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan doing Bob Dylan. Well, the man responsible for this whole folk pop movement is a guy by the name of Tom Wilson, who is an A&R man, an artist and repertoire man for Columbia Records in New York. And he is responsible for recording all of the folk people on Columbia Records. So he records Dylan and Pete Seeger, the Clancy Brothers, he records Art and myself, he records Judy Roderick, a few of the people. And it was his idea to put beat musicians behind Dylan. See, so if there are any poison pen letters to be sent out, Tom Wilson is the man to do it. Anyway, there is, let me think. Oh, yeah. Various groups in the States doing it, Johnny and his mental eunuchs and so forth. Well, being recorded by Wilson ourselves, we have had very little chance to escape this thing. So what he said to us is, why don't you do a folk pop record, you know? So he said, what the hell, we're not selling any folk records. We might as well do that. So we rewrote the words to Wednesday morning, 3 a.m., and we put it into a beat thing. So we'll give you a taste of that. Whoops.
I can hear the soft breathing of the girl that I love as she lies here beside me, asleep with the night, and her hair in a fine mist floats on my pillow, reflecting the glow of the winter moonlight. But I've got to creep down the alleyway, fly down the highway, before they come to catch me, I'll be gone.
Can't find me. Yeah. Like a rolling stone.
Paul might have been pretty scathing about folk rock at the beginning of September 1965, but in just a few weeks he would be changing his tune. Basking in the applause of folk club audiences, he'd even recorded an album in London, the Paul Simon Songbook. He was now used to reading glowing reviews of his performances. In the specialist magazine Folk Scene, for instance, the organizer of the Grimsby Folk Club wrote to say that of all visiting singers, Paul Simon was by far the most popular. Well, it was certainly a case of today, Grimsby, tomorrow, the world. Because back home in the States, events were beginning to overtake Simon and Garfunkel.
Wednesday morning, 3 a.m., the album that had existed now about a year was generating interest in radio stations in Florida, the Daytona Beach, Cocoa Beach area. And kids were calling in for one particular song called The Sound of Silence. And the CBS promotion man was saying to New York, you really should do something with it. There's a constant, consistent, cult-like following for that song. So CBS, mind you now, a year after the release of Wednesday Morning, I'm coming home from England in September to go back to school. Paul stays on. Now he's up to 5 or 6 months. He's in love with Kathy Chitty. He's living in Old Brompton Road in Knightsbridge. And CBS overdubs those electric instruments in the sort of folk rock style. The Birds had Turn, 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 and Mr. Tambourine Man with that same electric 12-string style. So they do it to us, and when I get to New York, they play me what they have, and I go, interesting, very trebly, kind of whiny, but it fits the way records are today.
I said, well, this sounds like what's happening, but I still didn't think it was, I didn't think it was a hit. So when I heard it, I thought, yeah, look, I mean, they're the record company, and the record's dead anyway, so it's fine with me, and it certainly didn't sound like it was defacing anything. You know, it was the sound of the moment, because the other thing that was happening was that the Beatles and that form of electric guitar music was back in style. You know, two guitars, bass, and drums was back in style and hipper than anything American because of the sound, the hair, and the foreignness of it. And so it was hypergamy. The idea of marrying up, you know? Folk married up into the smartest echelon of rock and roll. And for me, I was now living permanently in England. So I felt, fine, whatever you want to do. That record's a dead issue. And anyway, I know what I'm doing. I'm here, and I'm playing in this scene, and I understand this scene. And it didn't bother me at all.
I didn't say I expected a hit. We had many failures by then. It had been a long time since we knew that putting out a record might work. So I go on to school, and September turns to October, and the record keeps. In November, it was moving into the top 20, and when it was number 8 in the country in early December, I wrote Paul in England saying, I think you have to come home now. Something's really happening here. And Paul says, this really broke my stride. I was so happy at this part of my life. To this day, I think Paul will say that that was the happiest time of his life, just before fame. Things were working in terms of he had a very healthy ego, and he had his guitar slung over his back, and the way, I'm sure he had the right black heels on his boots, you know. And Kathy was great. Nothing like having a stylish girlfriend at that age. She had a great look. She had that lean. She was better than Twiggy, but in that style. Kathy was wonderful. I fell in love with Kathy when I met her. You know, if you come from America, then you get an extra rose-colored glass picture of England. So that worked brilliantly for Paul. To England, where my heart lies. That says it.
And from the shelter of my mind, through the window of my eyes, I gaze beyond the rain-drenched streets to England, where my heart lies. My mind's distracted and diffuse. My thoughts are many miles away. They lie with you when you're asleep, and kiss you when you start your day. And a song I was writing is left undone. I don't know why I spend my time writing songs I can't believe, words that tear and strange rhyme.
To capitalize on their number one hit, The Sound of Silence, Simon and Garfunkel recorded a folk rock album which drew on the songs Paul had been writing in England. Their next single, their first British hit, was born, so legend has it, on Widnes Railway Station during a tour of folk clubs in the north.
I don't remember exactly where I wrote that song, but I doubt that I wrote it in one sitting in Widnes or Warrington, or they're all to me the same, a blur. Widnes and Warrington and Liverpool, I can't remember which is which. And I was writing the song, like, around that trip. It probably took me, I don't know, a week or something to write the song. And I guess I used the imagery of the railway station because that's how I was traveling.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand. And every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for me. Every day is an endless stream of cigarettes and magazines. Town looks the same to me, the movies and the factories, and every stranger's face I see reminds me that I long to be homeward bound. I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts are escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently. Tonight I'll sing my songs again, I'll play the game and pretend. But all my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, like emptiness and harmony. I need someone to comfort me. Homeward bound, I wish I were.
The sleeve of the Sounds of Silence album portrayed the duo as hip young troubadours, English university scarves underlining their desire to target college audiences, but also fostering an impression of Simon and Garfunkel as earnest academics, too serious and troubled to have any fun.
Yes, it's true. It was very hard for us to convey what our sense of humor was on record. Our early shows, I mean, had a lot to do with humor. It was a lot of talking, and a lot of it was funny. And it was very New York. But on record, either those songs that had humor in them were not hits, or people didn't know that we were joking, or the songs that were more serious were just more attractive. But in either case, it started pretty early on that we were given this very serious graduate student label. Well, that's what we looked like anyway. And in fact, I mean, it's pretty much what we were, really. I mean, Artie was a graduate student in the early days. He was still at school.
Simon and Garfunkel's response to their weighty image was to invent spoof titles for future albums.
Our favorite was Simon and Garfunkel, So Young Yet So Full of Pain. That was our number one title that we used to laugh about.
A winter's day in a deep and dark December. I am alone, gazing from my window to the streets below on a freshly fallen silent shroud of snow. The walls, headboard steep and mighty, that none may penetrate. I have no need.
friendship causes pain. It's laughter and it's loving I disdain. I am a rock. I am an island. I have my books and my poetry to protect me. Feels no pain, and an island never cries.
In England, Paul had regularly introduced I Am a Rock as his most neurotic song, but the lyrics could also be the source of much hilarity. Sharing nights of summer madness at Judith Pieppi.
An earnest school of songwriting, you know, when you put seven times as many words as you need into a song. Brevity was not the soul of our wit when we were young. He began singing the line. He sang, on a freshly fallen, silent shroud of snow. And then he fell over on the floor and started laughing. And he lay on the floor. And I was the only one in the room who wasn't stunned. So I remember this very, very clearly. Like, Paul and Artie were rolling around. Paul particularly was upside down and sort of like rigid with laughter.
He personified the lines. Paul felt as the songwriter, he imagined he was the businessman behind the desk, and all the entrants who come into the office are the writers. Freshly Fallen Silent Shroud of Snow would come in, and they all sought to get into one of Paul's songs, and they're all people. A winter's day, in a deep and dark December, waiting in the waiting room, trying to get in. Well, I'm not sure I can use you for this song. Words of the Prophets written on the subway walls. Can't use you yet, but if you can give your name and if we can get back to you, I think I can use you later. That's right. Freshly Fallen Silent Shroud of Snow. That was a woman. We called her Freshly. Freshly my...
It's an intriguing image. The man who critics saw as Mr. Alienation, flat on his back, laughing over lines in his songs. But of course, he was passionate and ambitious about his role as a songwriter at a point when rock music was being treated seriously for the first time.
It was, you know, on the one hand, it was liberating. And on the other hand, of course, it led to an explosion of pretension, which characterizes an awful lot of the music from the 60s. So, I mean, you have a group of people who are in their early 20s who are suddenly being considered very seriously for the first time in their lives, perhaps even being called poets. And what you saw along with the occasional good example of record making and writing was just a lot of pretentious stuff. And I was a contributor to some of that myself.
And you read your Emily Dickinson and I my Robert Frost. And we note our place with bookmarkers that measure what we've lost. Like a poem poorly written, we are verses out of rhythm, couplets out of rhyme, in syncopated time. And the dangling conversation and the superficial sigh are the words of our lives. Yes, we speak of things that matter with words that must be said. Can analysis be worthwhile? Is the theater really dead? And how the room has softly faded. You're a stranger now unto me, lost in the dangling conversation and the superficial sighs in the borders of our lives.
too delicate to rise any higher than number 25 on the American Singles Chart, The Dangling Conversation was soon featured on Simon & Garfunkel's third album, Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme, released at the end of 1966. The opening track revealed that they were still savoring the fruit of their English summer.
Scarborough Fair, I first heard sung by Martin Carthy. Of course, a lot of people were singing Scarborough Fair. But Martin Carthy, he made it his own because of his guitar arrangement. And I was essentially playing my impression of his guitar arrangement. And then the counter melody line was Artie's line. He wrote it. There was something magical about that recording. We were in a studio. I think we had like 100 candles lit. It was like a very moody type of atmosphere.
In my mind, it wanted to have a counter melody filling all the in-between lines to make it even more flowing. So Paul and I wrote the counter melody. We broke down his second song he ever wrote, On the Side of a Hill, which was never recorded, therefore available.
And the war rages on in a land called somewhere. And generals order their men to kill. And to fight for a cause they've long ago forgotten. While the little cloud weeps on the side of a hill.
We used some of the lyrics from that anti-war song, and I wrote the melody. And it was completely a case of following what the record tells you it wants. I never had such an organic experience.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. Once was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cambric shirt, a deep forest green. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme was so much fun. And I remember by the time it was finished, sitting back, lighting up a joint, listening to this music for the first time without my rational head, but in that funny place, and thinking, oh boy, is this fun to listen to. This record works. I count that as about the high point in my life. I would say that I don't know when I was ever more pleased than to have made something I thought was beautiful and to now sit back and listen to it.
Tell her to reap it in a sickle mill of blazing in scarlet battalion.
There began for me the fun of taking charge. From that point on, the thrill of making a really wonderful album and having it sound great and
not just accommodating the market, the fact that you're hot so they want product, but saying, let me decide and have all the fun in what that product is. Gosh, what fun it was to pick your overdubs and to fuss and polish and change. And I thought that was the hottest thing going, to make an album be a great adventure, not an accommodation to a marketplace, but the same thing that a novelist does when he writes a great book. It fell into that category.
Further adventures with the landmark albums Bookends and Bridge Over Troubled Water next week in the concluding part of the Simon and Garfunkel story, When You Hear It, You'll Love It. The program was co-written by Pete Frame and the series producer Kevin Howlett and was an independent production for Radio 2 by Howlett Media Productions. This is Paul Gambaccini. Thanks for listening. Hello, this is Paul Gambaccini. Welcome to the concluding part of the Simon and Garfunkel story. When you hear it, you'll love it.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy. Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy. Hello, lamppost, what you knowin'? I come to watch your flowers growin'. Ain't you got no rhymes for me? Do-it-do-do, feelin' groovy. Ba-da-da-da-da-da, feelin' groovy. I got no deeds to do, no promises to keep. I'm dappled and drowsy and ready to sleep. Let the morning time drop all its petals on me. Life, I love you, all is groovy.
Feeling Groovy, or the 59th Street Bridge Song, celebrating the bridge which connected Paul Simon's childhood home in Queens with the musical scene in Manhattan. 1966 was a happy and creative time for Simon and Garfunkel. Musical excellence was always the priority. On their hit album, Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme, Paul had no hesitation about surrendering to his partner one of his most beautiful ballads, For Emily, Whenever I May Find Her.
We were not competitive in that sense. I didn't feel I had to keep my best songs for myself. We were very comfortable with each other. We'd known each other for a long time. We were best friends. And I tried to use all the strengths that the group had in making the record. And those kind of, you know, lush ballads, they were more Artie's taste anyway. And they were probably better suited to his voice.
The first thing I think about with that song is what a great lover Paul Simon is. I mean, I've never been in bed with him. I don't know. But I assume he's a very caressing lover, because if you listen to him play the 12 string underneath my voice, that carriage, that ride he's providing for the vocalist is very intimate and very beautiful. He's so underneath my vocal and swelling just where the vocal is swelling. Clearly the friendship is a really close one. You can hear it so much on that. It's almost like anybody could sing great if you get such an instrumentation like that supporting you. A good musician is a good listener. So he's doing a lot of moment-to-moment following what his friend Artie's going to do. Is Artie going to do the way he always does it and get louder on that one word? Is he going to break it off? And he's listening with it, you know, so finely, because we're so tight. At this point, we're friends since 13 years old. That's a close friend. So it shows up in the music that we're reading each other's next musical intention, even though it's a hundredth of a second away. We know, based on what's happening in the present, what the immediate next future is going to go to. It's just musicians being very together.
What a dream I had, pressed in organdy, clothed in crinoline of smoky burgundy, softer than the rain. I wandered empty streets down past the shop displays. I heard cathedral bells tripping down the alleyways. As I walked on, and when you ran to me, your cheeks flushed with the night.
in a burn lamplight, I held your
months since The Sound of Silence, Simon and Garfunkel had risen quickly in America's new rock hierarchy, and in spring 1967, they were invited to join Lou Adler and Papa John Phillips as principal organizers and hosts of the Monterey Pop Festival, a hippie celebration of unprecedented scale. Its astonishing lineup featured only those acts which the committee considered worthy, ranging from Ravi Shankar to Otis Redding. Coinciding with the peak of Californian flower power and LSD experimentation, the festival was a dazzling eye-opener to the New Yorkers.
It was really our first significant exposure to hippies and hippies in the music world. But it was fun. We thought we were out of it. I mean, we just didn't feel that we were a part of what was happening, but we didn't object to it. We liked that. We just felt we couldn't actually spend a lot of time in the teepee. But we liked the idea that there was a teepee up. It seemed that seemed, you know, if you came from New York and there was an actual teepee and people were living inside it, that seemed like it was fun. And Owsley was there, you know, the acid guy, and he was handing out acid like they were M&Ms to people. We just felt that we were not really a part of that scene, but we felt comfortable around it and we had some friends in it. But it was not a very New York thing. But I mean, taking acid on the streets of New York was not going to be as pleasant as taking it in the mountains of Monterey. And what it was going to produce in terms of music and art was going to be different than what happened in California. We were definitely East Coast people.
We were East Coasters. We never loved California. When Paul writes, I'm such a dubious soul, and a walk in the garden, and a walk in the garden wears me down. He's saying, when I hang around with these hippies, all this love stuff brings out my cynical edge, or I'm not sure if I trust all this lovey. That's the New Yorker's legacy.
Such a dubious soul.
Face and hands. I am the tailor's face and hands.
Not long after Monterey, Paul was approached to write songs for a movie, The Graduate, currently in production. It was not the kind of work he'd been attracted to before, but something about the offer was irresistible.
Mike Nichols. Very persuasive guy. I didn't like the book. I thought the book was bad Salinger, really. But Mike was very persuasive. And so we agreed to do it, and then I started to write songs. And in the meantime, he was cutting the movie and using earlier Simon & Garfunkel records as a temp track. And then he became wedded to those songs. And so the only new song that made it into the movie was Mrs. Robinson. I mean, I don't know how far along I'd gotten anyway about writing new things. We worked on the movie. We enjoyed it. We enjoyed hanging around with Mike. And it was fun to be on the soundstage. And, you know, we sang right to the film.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know.
The song was only half finished when we put it into that movie. There are no lyrics in the verses. There's no, we'd like to know a little bit about you. None of that had been written yet. So we're just going, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. There is the chorus, Mrs. Robinson. So you have to time it, you know. Dustin is in his car breaking through a tunnel into the air, and you have to come out just on the chorus there, and all that stuff has to be timed right.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you.
The Graduate was a critical and box office sensation, lifting the unknown Dustin Hoffman to instant stardom and winning an Oscar for director Mike Nichols. Simon & Garfunkel's music was also acclaimed for its appropriate mood setting, and despite the duo's reservations, Columbia Records saw enormous potential in releasing a soundtrack album.
I was opposed to it. I thought there was too much filler material in there. You know, music that was written for the band and the cocktail lounge or something. It wasn't my music. And a lot of the songs were available on earlier LPs, so I really didn't want to do that. And they put the album out over my objections. And they quickly sold about 3 or 4 million albums. And then that was really the enormous popular breakthrough of Simon & Garfunkel. It was reached a phenomenon of proportions.
We like to know a little bit about you for our lives. We like to help you learn to help yourself. Look around you, all you see are sympathetic eyes. Stroll around the grounds until you feel at home. And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Hiding in a hiding place where no one ever goes. Put it in your pantry with your cupcakes. It's a little secret, just the Robinsons are there. Most of all, you got to hide it from the kids. Coo-coo-ca-choo, this is Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey.
We didn't really peak until like 1968, but we were still pretty popular. Not as popular as the Beatles or the Stones. Pretty popular. And then by 1968, We were probably the biggest selling American group.
A worldwide hit, Mrs. Robinson won 2 Grammy Awards for Simon and Garfunkel, one for Record of the Year and one for Best Performance by a Vocal Group. The Graduate soundtrack album also won a Grammy. After 9 weeks at the top of the American charts, it was only dislodged by the new Simon and Garfunkel studio album, Bookends. As on previous records, they benefited from the unfettered enthusiasm of Columbia's wizard engineer, Roy Halley. In capturing the many moods and textures envisaged by the duo, he was able to indulge himself as never before, especially on the track Save the Life of My Child.
We were really stretching out in a lot of ways here. There's a lot of phasing and flanging going on to make that chorus sound much bigger, you know. Columbia Records. To do that particular thing, we were doing it out in California. I remember I had to use, like, and I'm not exaggerating, about 8 or 10 tape machines. And they were lined up out in the hall because I couldn't get them in the control room. And when everybody was going crazy. Why do they have to have every tape machine in the building on that? Why do they need all those tape machines? God, of course I couldn't explain to them. Just trust me, guys. Just trust. When you hear it, you'll love it. Yeah, but you don't need all those tape machines. Literally had them lined up in this hallway to create that sound. And it worked. I mean, they heard it and they said, well, we know what you did, but it's great.
Columbia had willingly dispensed with any supervisory producer for Simon and Garfunkel, leaving Paul, Art, and Roy to their own devices. But they became increasingly frustrated by the trio's relentless quest for perfection and their flagrant disregard for deadlines.
They periodically wanted to know whether, you know, where the album was, and it was late and it wasn't on schedule. And, I mean, I remember once they suspended us because we hadn't reached a deadline. They wanted the Bookends album to be done faster. They wrote a letter saying the contract is suspended, and I don't know what it meant. It didn't mean anything, you know? It was just a threat.
These days, Clive Davis was the head of Columbia Records. Bookends was very late in delivery, and Clive had a meeting with us. He did all the talking, we did all the listening. His point was, you gotta come, he used the phrase come across a million times. You gotta come across, meaning, don't be busy being so artful when we all know this business is about profits and sales. He would say, you fellas love to go out to L.A. and you hang out with all these stars, but there's no one at these parties that is not selling records. The ticket of admission is sales. You know, who doesn't know these things? But now, how shall I tell him, Clive, but do you know what a wonderful record is? Do you know what a very wonderful record is? Do you think there's any important difference? Suppose I said, we're going to make a very, very, very wonderful record. Does any of that mean anything to you? To me, that's my... Ever since I got lucky enough to get on records, it's only been about that. I don't really want to make a bad record that's profitable. I only want to have the fun of taking this game higher. Go explain that to the record company. It's impossible.
Let us be lovers. We'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes and dishes, wine, the pies, and walked off to look for America. Kathy, I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh. Seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. Be careful, his bow tie is really a camera. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. We smoked the last one an hour ago. So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching and I don't know. Cause I'm the New Jersey Turnpike. They've all come to look for America. All come to look for America. All come to look for America.
America, from the album Bookends, which was finally released in May 1968. Within days, Simon & Garfunkel had America's number one single and the three top-selling albums, and this commercial success allowed them to be even more ambitious. In 1969, their only release was a single, The Boxer, a truly epic track whose elements were pieced together in several locations over a period of many weeks.
I recorded the guitars with Fred Carter, who's from Nashville, and then overdubbed the drums. That's when we started using drums, like hitting drums in elevator shafts, and you know, to get huge echo sounds. There was an open elevator shaft in the Columbia Records building where they had their studio, and we would put the drums out there, and Roy would run long cables and microphones out into the elevator shaft.
Drummer Hal Blaine.
Roy found a place right in front of an elevator door. And I think we were on the fifth or sixth floor of the CBS building. And there was no one in the building except us. It was a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon. And I was set up with my monster drums right in front of the elevator. Now, I was wearing headsets, of course, listening to the track of The Boxer. la-di-da, boom, and I would hit those drums. La-di-da, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, boom. Well, in perfect synchronization, at one point, as my hands were coming down to smash the drums, the elevator door opened, and there was a very elderly rent-a-policeman standing there in his little gray uniform with the look of disbelief like he had just been shot with a shotgun or something. As I smashed the tremendous blow to the drums, this afterbeat, and he stood there petrified, and the doors closed, and away he went, never to be seen again. And I'm sure that he had wished he'd retired years before.
And then the horns were recorded up in this little chapel at Columbia University that had a good echo, nice echo. Horns and strings were recorded there.
Roy Halley.
To me, my personal opinion, one of the best records that was ever made. It's the best engineered Simon and Garfunkel record. The most creativity went into that record. When we were at the church doing the voices, we decided to put a piccolo trumpet. Piccolo trumpet, right? Not because of Penny Lane. A piccolo trumpet over a steel guitar playing that melody. Da, ba, 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 ba. To just superimpose that on the pedal steel to give it a different sound. That's what that is. And that the pedal steel was recorded in Nashville, and the piccolo trumpet was recorded as a remote in this church where we did the voices, and it's a classical trumpet player playing that. Also, we brought in a tuba player to play that big pedal note in the chorus in that church. I always said if anybody knew what went down to do this, they wouldn't believe it. And to this day, if anybody starts, you know, I get this look like impossible. I mean, you know, come on. Wild strings? How'd you get them to sink in? They sink in perfectly. Had the voices and they, how'd you? Nah. No. No. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Oh, the dobro lick? Wild track? Yeah, wild track. Not only wild track, but phased and flanged. Come on. Yeah, I get these looks like. Really, you write a book about that record, I'm telling you. You could absolutely write a book about how that record was done.
I am just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I have squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. When I left my home and my family, I was no more than a boy in the company of strangers, in the quiet of the railway station, wet and scared. Seeking out the poorer quarters where the ragged people go, looking for the places only they would know. Lie-la-lie. Wages. I come looking for a job, but I get no offers. Just to come home from the wars on 7th Avenue. I do declare there were times when I was so lonesome I took some comfort there. La 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 la. And wishing I was gone, oh, home, where the New York City winters
is hungry. And a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every glove that laid him down or cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, I am leaving, I am leaving, but behind him still remains.
That sounds very much Paul, to say, I've taken a lot of scars. In those years, Paul was very fond of wearing the pose of I'm wounded, I get knocked a lot. I don't know why. I mean, the world was buying our records a lot, but that's, it's a posture. So I guess he's saying, no matter what they do to me, I just keep going.
I think, well, that must have been me emotionally at that point. Whatever my conscious intention, it seems to me that it's an awful lot about me. Now, I don't remember that I wrote it that way, or even with that awareness at that point, but it sounds like me. I never liked criticism, and I never had that much belief in the praise. So, I was vulnerable.
A top 10 single, The Boxer, was a foretaste of the next Simon & Garfunkel album, Bridge Over Troubled Water, a record which quickly outsold any previous release in the history of rock music. Building on the blueprint of Paul's gospel-inspired demo, the structure of the title track evolved over several days of experimentation between Art and piano player Larry Nechtel.
When you're weary, feeling sad, when peace is all you seek, I'll be there. Ooh.
Paul showed it to me in his East End Avenue apartment one day, and he sang it in his very nice falsetto. Paul has a lovely fluty falsetto. It's very dreamy and like helium. And when I heard him use that falsetto, it wasn't the first time I said this. I would say this very often. Paul, you got to exploit your falsetto. It's one of our really valuable sounds in our arsenal. Shouldn't you sing that? He said, no, I wrote this for you. I then immediately said, okay, that's another great way to do it. Don't think I won't make a wonderful vocal out of it. So I had a great time doing it. I began to feel proprietary about, as if I know what Bridge Over Troubled Water wants, because I see where the vocal wants to go. By the time I come to the end of the verse, like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down, I knew that the repeat, like a bridge over, I didn't want to just do it again. I said, Larry, we want this second repeat to set up the turnaround. We're going to do an elaborate turnaround that's going to take things down and set up the second verse. The way Paul has written it, there ain't enough space to do that. Let me see if I can help you find chords that will stretch this out. So the ends of the verses, I'm writing, and Larry's playing the da 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 da.
Those kind of things, I don't know a lot about. It just happened, you know. I just lucked out. And then I had the idea for the tag at the end, you know, the reprise. And some of the chord changes, you know, the diminish. That was my idea to do that. But the song was still Paul's.
Simon and Garfunkel were so delighted by the ingenuity and majesty of Larry Nechtel's playing that they credited him on the label alongside their own names.
They wanted an introduction. There's certain traditions in gospel music, so I borrowed, or tried to remember them. And so I came up with starting with the bass in the fifth. And a diminished chord. And then the flat, Paul didn't have those. And I think I did it three times instead of twice. That's the intro.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. I'm on your side. Oh, when times get
I'm doing anything I can to support the lyric. I want the lyric to look tender and carry that story. A singer's job is to tell the story more than it's anything. If the song is well written, then that means the lyric is poignant. Well, make it maximally poignant. Work the mic close. Have your brain engaged with what you're saying. If it's tender and if it says, if you're in trouble, I'll be there, then be a papa. Be a strong guy who can be leaned on. And that's all I'm thinking as I'm singing that. You know, sail on by. That diction is not really white. So this shows that Paul and Art, I mean, we knew, this goes back to Alan Freed. It's that stuff we're borrowing in our diction. It's white kid doing a black style kind of sound. You can get a lovely intensity that way. Come to shine. The word is shine, not shine. But that's just, that's the rock and roll legacy that an American white kid learns, which is essentially black. Mind you, I'm doing that when I'm singing with Paul and Harmon at the end, but as I'm doing the verses, I'm trying to be more sincere. So it's the tender, sincere sound I'm really doing.
The album was full of contrast. Just moments after the soaring strings brought Bridge Over Troubled Water to an emotional conclusion, the homespun rhythms of Cecilia swept the listener in a totally new direction.
Eddie Simon, Paul's brother, was over visiting us, and Stewie Scharf, a friend of ours, was there, and Stewie took his cheap, dumpy guitar, some guitar that was around, really a tinny, cheap guitar. He slackened all the strings so they were rubber bands, turned them all out of tune. And he started strumming with his fingers choking the guitar. So it was just percussion. The da sound was the opening up of the strings by taking the choke sound off so they did ring for just the and of four. One and two and three and four and one and two and three. So yeah, they were little spikes. Eddie played the piano bench. The piano bench was padded. So he played four fours. So it's... This is Eddie's part. Hands on piano bench. Paul and I played hands on blue jeans. We played our own thighs. We had a ticky-tacky pattern in our thighs that we... And we sat across from each other, and we worked out a pattern almost in unison, but it was cute. When the four of us all had our instruments, we recorded it in our living room on the Sony sound-on-sound tape recorder, just a reel-to-reel tape recorder, but it had a nice reverb button. So when we recorded what we were doing between the reverb and the finger, the hands on blue jeans, it had a real sound, and we liked it. We brought it in, showed it to Roy. In those days, we didn't know you could do that. We said, now, is this a home demo that we have to start from scratch and record, or can you use this? He said, I can use that. And I can see us in the studio. I don't know, just where Roy was standing and where Paul was standing. And Paul shows Cecilia to us that he's working on. And he says, but I'm not going to do anything with it. And I say, we must do that song. That's pure commercial gold. That's an excellent song to balance out some of the artier things. That's we got to do that song because I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to sing Way Above You very high and real loud. This is a perfect song to get our hard edge. It's the shouting sound, which we hardly ever use. And it's going to sound very innocent and kid-like. I'm going to drop all of my Columbia College educated sound to get nice and dumb and simplistic.
Celia, you're breaking my heart. You're shaking my heart.
Very kind of happy moron sound.
happy spontaneity of Cecilia, many of the sessions for Bridge Over Troubled Water were soured by an atmosphere of increasing tension. At the beginning of 1969, Art had flown to Mexico to appear in the Mike Nichols movie Catch-22. Through no fault of his own, the schedule was extended. His prolonged absence from the studio was a cause of great frustration to both Paul and Roy Halley.
It was tense. It was really tense. Paul was angry, and I was angry, and that was hard. That was very, very, very hard. And when Paul would get the feeling that the record was secondary to the movie, naturally he was angry, and justifiably so. I mean, the guy's writing the songs, and he's writing. He's the writer. He's creating the cake, and we're putting the icing on the cake. Always, Paul created it. Without the creation, you have nothing. And he's angry. I don't blame him. I was too. I mean, you know, I like Artie a lot. He's a good friend, but I was angry at the time that that took precedence over what we were doing. The most important thing to Paul, obviously, and to me, is the record. That's what this life is all about, is this. That movie. What is this movie? I mean, that was my attitude. What? Movie? What are we doing movies for? We have to finish our record. My attitude was, what's more wonderful than music? Certainly not movies. Well, it was a lot of animosity, right? So animosity breeds that. If he says that, I'm going to say that, you know. So there was a lot of that tense vibe, you know. Artie would say something, Paul would disagree. Paul would say something, Artie would disagree. There was this war of the minds going on. I remember walking away, like going to the bathroom or something. I didn't. I was destroyed, absolutely destroyed.
We weren't functioning as that unit that we had made our previous records with, Artie and Roy and me. But on the other hand, by this point, we were not getting along particularly well. And I was having a good time making a record, essentially a solo record, with Roy. So really, I was making my first solo album. I was setting it up like a Simon and Garfunkel album. And then it occurred to me that we only had to sing about four songs or so together, and then three each separately, and we had an album. Didn't have to sing every song as a harmony, duo harmony, and it'd still be fine. So it really was the beginning of my first solo album, Bridge Over Troubled Water. The Boxer had been recorded earlier, so that was really, The Boxer is really like the peak of our collaborative period, because The Boxer is recorded in between Bookends and Bridge Over Troubled Water. There's a whole school of thought, I don't know how many people are in the school, but there's a whole school of thought that says that Bookends is really the quintessential Simon and Garfunkel album. Those kind of harmonies, that kind of guitar playing, and that by Bridge Over Troubled Water, you've already gotten to just past when it was ripe.
For Art, the cruelest cut followed his solo performance on So Long, Frank Lloyd Wright. Only after the record's release did he discover that the song was addressed to him.
I was very much aware that So Long, Frank Lloyd Wright was definitely about Artie, who was an architecture major. It was written tongue-in-cheek, but he sang it seriously, which is not, you know, not the way I intended it, but it worked out fine anyway.
When Paul says, I wrote Frank Lloyd Wright as a form of saying goodbye to you, he never let me in on it. So the joke is on me. Ha, ha, ha. And I, of course, have been enjoying the joke all these years. I say with an edge of displeasure. No, he never let me in on the fact that he evidently, in his mind, said, it's over after this group. I don't like that. I find that a secretive and unpleasant thing to have done to you.
So long, Frank Lloyd Wright, I can't believe your song is gone so soon. I barely learned the tune so soon. So soon. I'll remember Frank Lloyd Wright all of the nights we
Felt displaced by what I was doing in my filling in time while he was writing songs. And I chose to not wait, but to go make a movie. That I believe that was a threat to Paul's ego. By the time I made Carnal Knowledge and was starring in a movie, I think he has an ego that is such that he couldn't possibly support that. I find that one damn shame. Because I think I had every right to step out, to be talented in other areas, and to bring it all back to this wonderful thing called Simon and Garfunkel, which I never wanted to see disband. Back around 1970, I wanted to see it take a rest, the Simon and Garfunkel thing. I was sure the juice was a little dried up, and that these guys would both profit from not seeing each other for a while, which is something every marriage and every friendship knows about. But I didn't want to kill it. I thought it was too great. A duo is a neat thing to have. A duo is intriguing. The fact that we were a public friendship, that we did concerts and people would look at us and wonder what's the vibe between them, was quite lovely to me. I love that that's the nature of our act, that we've got them interested in who we are. So I had no interest in seeing the group stop.
I think we were actually exhausted. It wasn't that I thought that we were musically exhausted, although in retrospect I think that we probably were. But we certainly were emotionally exhausted from disagreements about what the music should be, what scheduling problems we had, movies versus records, all kinds of arguments in that category. It just wasn't fun. It really wasn't fun. And we both were aware that it wasn't fun. But with Bridge Over Troubled Water, I'm not sure that with the completion of that album that I said to myself at that time, well, that's the last album I'll do. And I don't think that Artie said it either. I think he said to himself, take a break now and do some other projects. I'm sure he was thinking, I'll do another movie, which was Carnal Knowledge. Shortly after that, into the tour of Bridge Over Troubled Water, that last tour, I know that I felt I didn't want to do this. It wasn't any fun. I didn't really like it.
In Britain, Bridge Over Troubled Water remained on the album chart for almost 6 years, spending a total of 41 weeks at number one, an achievement that no other rock album has come near to equaling. In March 1971, it swept the Grammy Awards, winning 6 in all. But by this time, Simon and Garfunkel's partnership was over. Despite occasional concert reunions, they never made another studio album. But the recordings they made together during the late 60s are enduring classics.
To me, the word recording implies lasting quality. If you make a record of a particular performance that afternoon, you must be talking about it will last tomorrow, next decade. I would have used the phrase back in those days, I want this to last into the 21st century. I'm making a record.
When you go to the museum and there's Vermeer 450 years later, it means he was so damn wonderful that it lasts. Well, I was aware of that and thought that the record business might include such achievements if you go for it. The Beatles hipped me to that and how wonderful their records were. And to me, it came natural that you record with an attempt to strike a mark.
The Simon and Garfunkel Story was co-written by Pete Frame and the series producer Kevin Howlett and was an independent production for Radio 2 by Howlett Media Productions. This is Paul Gambaccini. Thanks for listening.